Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So I've been thinking about faith for a while, trying to think about some things to say about it. And so on Thursday, when I found out I was doing this Dharma talk, that popped into my mind, and what popped in with it was this little song that I learned, I think probably as a child. And here's how it goes. Have faith, hope, and charity. That's the way to live successfully. How do I know? The Bible tells me so. Do good to your enemies, and the blessed Lord you'll surely please. How do I know? The Bible tells me so. Don't worry about tomorrow, just be real good today. The Lord is right beside you, He'll guide you all the way. Have faith, hope, and charity, that's the way to live successfully. How do I know? The Bible tells me so. So that's a... That's a catchy little jingle, like any advertisement you're likely to hear. And it's easy to dismiss it as a childish thing. And yet, these somewhat old-fashioned words, biblical words, speak of values that we also cherish in Buddhism as well. So I thought I would explore those just a little bit. Let's start with faith. One way we sometimes think of faith is that it's a belief in something on the basis of no evidence, often because someone tells you to do so, which is a great way to control people if they let you. Controlling someone's belief system allows you to control their lives. However, this directly contradicts what the Buddha taught. On his deathbed, he exhorted people, his followers, not to believe something until or unless and unless they could prove it for themselves from their own experience. So we take the teachings as points of inquiry, testing them to see what's true. So much of what we believe is actually not true. This is called wrong view or wrong understanding, and that's addressed in the very first step on the Eightfold Path and what doesn't. We compare notes, we learn from and with each other, and begin to develop our ability to connect with others and ourselves with compassion. This is taking refuge in Sangha. These are the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. They are a profound statement of where we put our faith. And of course, there's much more to be said about each of them. So I'm going to move on to hope. This is not usually a virtue we celebrate in Buddhism, again, as it is often defined. The trap there is that it too often means looking for something to happen in the future that will make us happy, because what's happening right now isn't okay. And often what is being hoped for is unrealistic or maybe not even beneficial. Those who hope that a new home or a new car or a new relationship will fix their lives are almost always disappointed if they get those things. So that led me to remember Pema Chodron's little book, When Things Fall Apart. And she has a chapter in there called Hopelessness and Death. And she actually encourages hopelessness. Here's what she says. If we're willing to give up hope that insecurity and pain can be exterminated, then we can have the courage to relax with the groundlessness of our situation. This is the first step on the path. Turning your mind towards the Dharma does not necessarily bring security or confirmation. Turning your mind towards the Dharma does not bring any ground to stand on. In fact, when your mind turns towards the Dharma, you fearlessly acknowledge impermanence and change and begin to get the knack of hopelessness. In Tibetan, there's an interesting word, ye tang che. The ye part means totally or completely, and the rest of it means exhausted. Altogether, ye tang che means totally tired out, we might say, totally fed up. It describes an experience of complete hopelessness, of completely giving up hope. This is an important point. This is the beginning of the beginning. Without giving up hope that there's somewhere better to be, that there's someone better to be, we will never relax with where we are or who we are. An interesting viewpoint. Not particularly reassuring, or maybe it is. Maybe there is something useful about hope after all. If we look at our lives and find some things not as we would wish, what do we do? If we sit still and look closely, we find ways that we are not living as skillfully as we would like. We begin to realize that a lot of our problems arise directly from our own minds and our own behavior. In the Kyoju Kaimon, which outlines the precepts, this is addressed in the contrition verse. It sounds a little strange that our hope lies in seeing more clearly what the problem is and that we are the source of our own suffering. But that is where we can begin to create a better life. It is the beginning of the beginning, as Pema Chodron says. We form an aspiration and hope that we can do better. We express vows when we take the precepts, when we take term vows. Residents and guests at Dharma Rain in the morning, each morning at breakfast, we express intentions for the day. This is an interesting and powerful practice over time. It provides a snapshot of what I want to work on and be aware of just for today. It is in many ways a true expression of hope, coming from our own experience and pledging our best effort to the process. So now we come to charity. I'm currently reading a mystery series where the author occasionally talks about something being as cold as charity. It made me chuckle, but I also recognized an approach to doing good works out of a sense of duty, often begrudged. The first dictionary definition of charity is an organization that provides aid to those in need. So institutional giving. And yes, sometimes that can be cold. The way the word charity is used in the Bible, however, is more like the word love. And we see that this is another word that gets used in lots of ways with many different meanings. Biblically, the highest kind of love is that between God and mankind. Which then leads me to the Brahma Viharas. So in Buddhist teachings, we speak of the four Brahma Viharas, the divine abodes, the four immeasurables. The first two are metta, loving kindness, and karuna, compassion. Typically, when we speak of love, we're talking about the first one, a feeling of benevolence and goodwill. This is often directed at particular beings, including and indeed starting with ourselves, but can also be more generally about all beings. Compassion, on the other hand, though literally translated in English as feeling with, is in Buddhist terms more about seeing the suffering of others and wanting to bring an end to that suffering. This aligns it more closely with charity, doing helpful things to aid those in need. There can also be a sense of coolness with compassion. Loving kindness is straightforwardly warm, benevolent, goodwill. The third Brahma Vihara is mudita, sympathetic joy, and is similarly warm and sunny. The fourth one, though, upekkha, equanimity, has always seemed pretty cool to me, and yet it is said to be the basis of the other three. Equanimity is the ability to remain in balance no matter what happens. It speaks of acceptance of all things, of patience, of forbearance, and in fact, faith that things are as they should be. This is one of the hardest teachings for many people to accept. When we look around us and see suffering everywhere, it can be hard to accept that. The question that arose for me when I was wrestling with compassion was, how can I accept the unacceptable? A good question to hold. And indeed, it is possible to cross over into indifference in the face of overwhelming suffering, a feeling of hopelessness, into it just doesn't matter. Indifference is described as a near enemy of equanimity in that it can look like it, but isn't really it. Avalokiteshvara, whom we call Kanzayan, is the bodhisattva of compassion. The original name is translated as the one who looks down. We say that she sees the cries of the world, so she is the one who sees suffering. The statue here in our own hall shows her seated at royal ease, which is one of the common depictions of her. To me, she is showing this sense of equanimity in that she's not knocked off her seat by the suffering that she sees. Her eyes are open, and you know that she cares, which is the opposite of indifference. The other common depiction of Kanzayan is the one with 1,000 arms. On each hand, there is an eye that sees, and sometimes also a tool to help someone out of a tough spot. So here we have both that clear-eyed seeing and also the ability to help, to give aid to those who are suffering. When I first came to Buddhism, I was looking for several things. Uppermost, I think, was that desire to help. I see that same desire in everyone I meet. I believe it is a universal human trait, like love itself. Granted, in some people it's buried fairly deep, but I think it's always there. I was already aware of some difficulties, though, for myself. So often when we try to help, we end up either being ineffectual or sometimes even making things worse. The feeling was there, but I wasn't sure about the how, the action, and I wanted to learn skills towards doing this better, maybe to gain some of Kanzayan's tools. I remember once watching a mother with a crying baby. After checking to make sure the baby was fed, properly clothed, and was likely just tired or just generally feeling bad, She finally just held the baby close to her, head resting on her shoulder. She spoke soothingly to her, rubbed her back lightly, and let her do what she needed to do. What struck me about that was how rare this is. So often when we encounter another person in distress, we just want it to stop. This is actually a rejection, a turning away. As a child, I was told not to cry, to get over it, just stop it. And I was sometimes even punished for it. Like the compliant child I was, I learned not to cry. This may help an observer feel better, but is not genuinely helpful to the one suffering. For me, it led to cutting me off from my own feelings in a damaging way that has taken years to recover from. Here's where you can begin to see the value of equanimity. When you can see and accept the fact of suffering, the First Noble Truth, without being knocked off your seat by it, then you can bring your whole compassionate heart to the situation. See clearly what you may offer, knowing that sometimes the most valuable offering is simply bearing witness calmly and allow things to unfold as they need to. This requires faith. It involves love. It involves wisdom. And it involves equanimity. They all work together. Faith involves the acceptance of things as they are. It has to do with engaging, participating, trusting, practicing, love. Hope, at its best, is paired with intention, the commitment to doing better. So I found myself playing around a little bit with this jingle, changing some of the words, and I didn't find it very hard. I did change hope to love and charity to compassion. So then I have this problem of finding something to rhyme with compassion on the next line. Let's see. Salvation? No, that's too Christian again. Let's see. Transformation? How about intention? That's better. How do I know? The teachings tell me so. Or even better, my practice tells me so. We can easily replace Blessed Lord with the Blessed One. The bridge speaks of living just for today, which accords very well with our practice, and only a very slight change to the end of that. So now, here's how it goes. Have faith, love, and compassion. That's the way to live with intention. How do I know? My practice tells me so. Do good to your enemies, and the Blessed One you'll surely please. How do I know? The teachings tell me so. Don't worry about tomorrow, just be real good today. The Buddha lives within you to guide you in the way. Have faith, love, and compassion. That's the way to live with intention. How do I know? The practice tells me so. So, any questions or comments? Just don't tell me I sing terribly. I know I don't, but still, there's always that insecurity.
Never again, Kev. For the folks on Zoom, if you have a question or comment, it looks like Daniel has question or comment. You can either type question or comment in the text box if you want to say that yourself. If you'd like me to say it for you, feel free to type the whole thing in, and we will alternate between Zendo and Zoom. So away we go, Daniel.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you.
Thank you very much for that. That was excellent. And a lot in that. One of Pema's books mentioned that it's tough to have compassion for others if you can't have it for yourself. So I've been kind of going into that a little bit. And charity, compassion seems like more of a feeling with equals, kind of rather than like an above and a below, you know, kind of a relationship. And I've realized that my compassion for myself has a lot of condescension. Kind of a, you'll get there eventually, buddy, keep trying kind of a feeling behind it. And the imagery that you, with the mother, just sort of letting the baby do its thing and, you know, just bearing witness calmly rather than wanting it to stop. And in the process, sort of rejecting, or, you know, kind of putting down how they're feeling was really powerful for me. And it's definitely something I have to work on a little bit more. So thank you for that.
I don't think I heard everything you said, but one of the things I heard was this business about being more equal instead of above and below. I find that the translation, the one who looks down, actually to be somewhat helpful in that it makes it a little easier for me to envision. Well, I love being up high and looking down on things. So like at the top of a mountain or the top of a building or whatever, it gives me a better sense of the overall of what's going on, and it separates a little bit out of the identification with what's going on there. And it takes a little bit of that emotional charge out of it, I think. So I actually found it like a helpful way to think of it, not so much as superior, inferior, that is, something's better or worse. It's just, it's a different viewpoint. And I find that to be helpful. Perhaps if you had another question in there that I missed, you could repeat it and kind of slow down a little bit, because it's just sometimes a little hard for me to hear some things in this hall.
Sure. And I guess it was more of a comment on something. Okay. I've been experiencing in my own practice. Uh-huh. Kind of that feeling of Maitri. I guess Pema gave an example of like a mother bird kind of looking at her baby birds, and the baby birds might not be as pretty, but she still loves them anyway.
Right.
And we're kind of both in that scenario. Uh-huh. you know, the loving kindness that we can give to ourselves, even to the maybe not so pretty parts of ourselves.
Right.
But I just found myself having a little bit of a, you know, condescending feeling to my compassion for myself, like, keep chugging along, little buddy, you'll get there eventually, sort of a feeling, rather than just, you know. And when I was, you know, feeling whatever I was feeling, kind of just wanting it to stop rather than just sort of witnessing it calmly, like you mentioned with the mother and her baby. Yeah. So I found a lot of what you said in that regard is very helpful. So thank you.
I think we have a comment or two. Oh, we have a bunch of hands here in the Zendo. Let's start over here with Reju. Or with Dawn. Reju. Somebody over here.
I remember the first time I encountered that Pema Chodron quote about hope, or I think it was something like, abandon all hope.
That's right.
And initially I was so taken aback, and then I really liked it because I read the rest of it and it made more sense. So I'm curious about hope, and I'm also curious about your pairing hope with intention and vow.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I'm signing off, like my friend said, oh, I got my second vaccine and now I feel terrible. And I said, well, I hope that you don't feel terrible much longer and that the immunity does last much longer.
Mm-hmm.
And in the morning when I'm saying my intention, it has a different sort of feeling than the feeling of, I'm trying to parse out, please say more about intention and vow and hope.
Yeah, that was about the only place I was feeling that I could go with hope, because we talk about aspiration too. Sometimes we'll use that word instead of intention or vow. I think the idea for me about intention and vow is that it is in fact an expression of hope. This is what I intend to do, what I want to do, what I hope will happen. Knowing at the same time that because of my own human frailty, that might not be the way it goes. And I will probably fail, you know, often more than once. And that's really just part of the process. So it's probably more accurate to say there's some faith in there. As long as we also understand that it's not a question of, this is what's going to happen, I know this is what's going to happen, and that's the way it is. As long as we can hold it more lightly as I don't have a good word for it, but I hope this is the way it's going to be, this is what I intend, what I hope for. So it's more like that.
I'm noticing a distinction maybe, like when I said to my friend, I hope you don't feel terrible much longer.
Right.
There's nothing I can do about her
feeling terrible.
It's like an extension, like an external thing.
Uh-huh.
But when I say in the morning, I intend to watch my breath or whatever it is.
Right.
Then it's an internal thing that I can attend
yes.
to.
Yes. Yes. There's someone else on Zoom, or we have some more here in the hall.
We are clear on Zoom for the moment.
All right.
Thank you for your talk, Genko. This is Yutone bowing in. Hello, Zoom. And thank you for your song. That made me really happy. especially the re-envisioning of the lyrics is really nice. Thank you. So I have a share and then a question about your experience. My experience is that when I first started practice years ago, I think that I had a pretty healthy amount of like subtly angry skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I have a particular memory that comes to mind a lot, that the first time I was trying to establish a meditation practice at home, I looked for a mindfulness bell on YouTube, and a video came up of a nun talking about how the sound of the bell had saved her life. And I became irrationally angry. It was a very shocking reaction. But I think it was like, what's this lady trying to sell me? You know, it was like, why would she lie like that? You know, it was kind of like a, ugh, just give me.
So you just didn't believe her? Is that why?
No, I didn't believe her at all. I thought, you know, like I was just like, oh, this, what foof, you know, like, foofy, you know, just give me a bell so I can do this. You know, like it was, and I remember talking about it with coworkers the next day of just like, it's just uncomfortable, like, ugh. And then over time, as I got more experience in the practice, my faith got a lot stronger, you know, and the kinds of doubt that I'm able to face now are a lot bigger. And I've gotten significantly more religious, like to the point that like I'm invoking celestial beings to walk the path with me, you know, that kind of practice. And so my question about your experience is, have you ever experienced significant discomfort with faith or skeptical doubt? Or have you, I know you had a Christian upbringing. I'm wondering if it's been comfortable for you, or what is it like for you? What has it been like in your practice, this experience of faith and hope?
Well, skeptical doubt. So we talk about, I talk about questioning and about asking skillful questions and about questioning the teachings. So bringing inquiry to it. So there's certainly nothing wrong with saying, how can a bell save your life? I mean, you know, that's a good question. But skeptical doubt says there's no way a bell can save your life. So it's not asking a question. Skeptical doubt tends to really like make statements and say, it's not possible this could happen. So asking an actual question, a sincere question, is a different kind of a thing. So we say we need great faith, great doubt, and great determination to do this practice. And so the kind of doubt we're talking about is the kind of doubt that asks questions. And it is interesting, isn't it, how our understanding grows with experience, and how our ability to say, oh, I'm starting to see that a bell could in fact save my life. It could be Buddha in a given moment. But you start realizing everything could be Buddha in a given moment. You know, there's all kinds of things out there that are seem to be designed actually to save our lives that we never noticed before. So, you know, and we have a particular set of experiences, of rituals, of teachings, of icons, of all kinds of things that are designed to help us on the path and to help us begin to see those kinds of things, to begin to see the Buddha in everything that we meet, for instance. And the fact that we don't see that immediately doesn't mean that it's not there. It just means that we've never encountered it that way, or nobody's ever told us that it could be like that. And sometimes when people tell you, it just sounds like that's just crazy. That's crazy talk, right? I mean, so I have an interesting time sometimes when I go and I talk to people in prison or people who are brand new and they ask me a question. I try to keep it pretty down to earth because I know, and sometimes I just acknowledge, this is something I can't find words for, you know? And there are just things like that. So that's kind of, I think that's what a lot of religion is about, is trying to find ways, words, actions, pictures, whatever, that can start pointing us towards some truth that we all know, really.
Thank you. And can you teach me that song later? That would be amazing.
What was that?
Can you teach me that song later? That would be amazing.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank
it's
you
a cute little song. We have another hand or two here in Zoom. I mean, we're not in Zoom.
On Zoom when you're ready, Genko.
Okay.
Let me unmute Eric here.
Good morning, Genko. Thanks for your talk. I love the singing.
Okay.
I was particularly struck by your reading of Pema, Children. Uh-huh. And I've got to admit, that's been one of the biggest surprises I've had in this practice is encountering that hopelessness at times. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the initial stage of hopelessness is despair, which fortunately eventually gives way to what I call, you know, acceptance and the opportunity for transformation. But making that transition from despair to acceptance is a big leap. And I know you encounter this a lot with your disciples and in Sanzen. I'd love to hear any other thoughts that you have while you're helping people to make that transition from despair to acceptance. Any other thoughts? I just would love to hear more talk about this issue of hope and hopelessness.
So despair, yes, I've definitely experienced that too on my journey, beginning to recognize there is a part of me that doesn't believe that any of this is ever going to get better. So, or that there's anything I can do to make it better. Those are slightly different, but they're related. And in that sense, it's somewhat connected with skeptical doubt because it's making a statement or have a belief that this is the way things are. It's terrible. It will always be like this. And it's probably even going to get worse, right? So that's kind of where you are when you're in despair. And as to how we transition from that to a sense of surrender that is actually more, hate to use the word hopeful, but maybe, but that allows for more possibilities. Maybe I'll put it that way. For me, that happened because I had the support of Sangha, because I was in a place where I felt safe enough to let go of my constant feeling of I have to control this, to allow things to be as they were, to let myself feel all of the pain and the fear that I had, which I hadn't really allowed myself to do because it didn't feel safe before. And I think everybody has a slightly different journey in that way. So sometimes I share that journey with people. And sometimes I encourage people to find their own way out because it may look a little different from mine. But I think it has to do, you do have to surrender to things as they are. You do have to get to that place where, yes, this is what's happening. I don't like it. But also then to recognize the I don't like it part is my own mind, my own preference that I'm bringing to it. And that maybe it doesn't have to be like that. Maybe my mind can have a different way to react to it or think about it and that in fact, maybe I can learn something from it that is helpful, beneficial. So I think a lot of what I end up doing, at least in my talks and in Sanzen, is a lot of encouragement, a lot of reassurance. Yes, this happens. Yes, this is normal. Yes, I think you're doing fine. Yes, just keep at it. It'll get better. You know, a lot of those kinds of things, because in fact, that's been my experience. That's the upside of impermanence is the way I always say it. Things are definitely going to change. And they might change for the better. You never know. Often they do. I have another one here.
Uh, I want to say thank you for your for the satsang. It was inspiring. It brought to my mind some of the things I've learned about compassion. I've been seeing it as giving people what they need rather than what they want, which of course takes discernment. But I think this analogy has been helpful as well in discerning between sympathy, empathy, and compassion. Sympathy is like you are walking and you see somebody in a hole and you say, oh, that really sucks. I'm sorry you're in that hole. Then you keep walking. Empathy is as you get down in the hole, you say, hey, I've been here before. I know what it takes to get out. Compassion is seeing a person in the hole, throwing them a rope. You don't have to know their situation. You just see a need and provide the help. I don't know. That's all I felt inspired to say.
So,
thank you.
I'm not sure I heard exactly what you said about. So compassion is you see them in the hole and what?
You throw them a rope.
Oh, you throw them a rope. Okay. Yeah, I was going to say maybe you give them a hand and help them out. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense to me. Yeah. So empathy sometimes will get you down in the hole and then you're both stuck. Right? And sympathy is like, oh, you poor thing. And talk about looking down and condescending. So it tends to be a little condescending. Oh, you know, that's really too bad that you're doing that. I'm not like that. So sucks to be you kind of thing. You know, that's one of those kind of deals. So yeah, that's an those are interesting distinctions. One of the problems that I get into with Dharma talks is that you have to use words. And and I'm a word person. I like that. I look things up in the dictionary and I try to figure out what's related to what and how is this different from that and whatever. And that's all useful stuff in terms of trying to understand what's going on. But at the end of the day, it has to do with how is this going to work for me? How is this going to affect my life? And how is it going to affect the people around me? So yeah, those are useful distinctions to realize what can be helpful and what maybe isn't going to be so helpful. And the whole thing about giving people what they need instead of what they want is very tricky because you're assuming you know what they need. And maybe you do. It's also tricky because they need to know what they need. And if they don't, and you think you do, and you like give them what you know they need, and they're not up for it, that doesn't work either. Right? So there's all these different factors to pay attention to. It has to do with really seeing the situation very clearly and finding what is going to be helpful there.
That's true. You can't be too consistent.
Yeah. Right.
Thank you.
And Kel, we have a question on Zoom from Daiko.
Okay.
Daiko? Me? Daicho?
Daicho, sorry.
Hi, thank you for your talk. So you mentioned, I think it's a famous one that part of the Buddha's last words, don't just believe what I said, you try it on. And I have a science background, and this sounds, in past few years, I had this reaction to this every time I heard it, and I when I thought about my reaction, it is that science. It seems like science, you know. Oh, you try it out and see if it works or not, and if it works, great. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But that's oftentimes, well, that works really well with something that's like outside of yourself. You know, if this screwdriver works or this iPad works. But often, well, practice is really not about that. Not something that we can really see, you know, see as something outside of us. And especially when something is like, the practice is where, you know, the outside and inside, the distinction is not that clear. And that in that place, I feel like, I guess part of me feel like, well, you know, try it out and see if it works. It seems like a little bit of a trick question, because oftentimes we have an investment when we, you know, try out something. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why those, you know, companies were saying, oh, try our product out. And, you know, if you don't like it, well, that's okay. But oftentimes we, you know, as Buddhism say, we change because of our action. If you choose something or this toothpaste or something, and then, you know, there's subtle investment there that we tend to say good things about this. And I feel like that's kind of important. Even in the scientist world, there's a lot of in history where, you know, some theory was really seemed successful just because, you know, the main scientists, good, you know, famous scientists were actually invested on it. And later it turned out that, well, not so much. So I guess, but my question here is that how do you recognize this investment part? Mm-hmm. When I try out something and I'd say, it's working well, but is it partly because I'm invested in this or partly because, you know, so this is my question. I mean, right. I'm not sure if there's any good answer for that, but sometimes I wonder about that. You know, I've been sitting for, 20 some years, and, well, I think it's good for me, but is that partly because I've just been doing this? Something like that.
Well, part of this has to do with, this is one of the reasons why we talk about not having a goal, about goallessness. So the goal isn't necessarily to make our lives feel better or to make us feel better. That's not the goal. So at some point we simply say, let's see what happens, and I'm just going to practice. So here's an analogy. Maybe we'll see if that's a good example. When I went to college the first time, right out of high school, I just struggled. And for years, and then I finally dropped out. And for years, I had this feeling about myself that I wasn't very good at this. I didn't have the right kind of ambition. I didn't have the right commitment, blah, blah, blah. And then several years later, it dawned on me, I didn't have the resources I needed to do this. But when I went back to school in my 40s, I found myself with a lot of anxiety coming up. And a lot of those same feelings of like, oh, well, I'm probably going to fail like I did before. And so the only way I could do it was, because I still didn't have a lot of resources. I was taking one or two classes a term and working full time. So I didn't, you know, I had enough, but I didn't have extra. So I thought, well, the only way I could do it was to say, okay, I'm going to ignore the fact that I talked with an advisor to figure out what I needed to graduate and let all of that go and just take the class for the experience of taking the class, because I had done that before many times. And, you know, that was what I had to do. So I think that's really what we do when we practice and we don't have the goal. We just get rid of the goal and say, whatever happens is whatever happens. So you have to hold things lightly like that. And when you do that, over a time, you start to look and say, look what I just look what I just did in that situation. 2 years ago, that would have been a very different story. I would have blown my top. I would have yelled at this guy, whatever. I mean, you know, you can kind of see how, or I, it would have just sent me into tears, or I would have, whatever, all kinds of things. And you can see it in retrospect. You usually can't see it while it's happening. That's been my experience about that kind of stuff. So after I took the first class, actually midway between that, in that first class, halfway through the term, and I was taking, I don't know, it was sort of an English comp class of some kind, a writing class, I don't remember. It was like, oh, this is fine. There's no problem at all. And then I realized I was just bringing back that old stuff to a new situation, which was not my situation anymore. So that's part of what we do, is we try to let go of a lot of the expectations. And I think what happens in the science things that you're talking about in corporations and whatever is they have an investment in, it needs to look like this. And then people do that too. It's like, well, I've been going to school to do this one thing for all this time, and now how can I give that up? Because now that I find that that's not the right thing to do. You know, it's like we do this thing and we think, well, then this is something that belongs to me. It's something that I have to take care of. Maybe not. Maybe let go. So that's all I can say about that. It's just a matter of, and that's part of the continual inquiry, which to me is the hallmark of good science, is you keep asking these questions. Is this true? Is this really gonna work? Is this really helpful? Or did somebody cook the books?
Yeah, thank you. I think I have that kind of, you know, identification with something that I was doing for a while, and I've lived long enough now that there are several things in my life that I identified with that eventually I just realized that, oh, it really belongs to the past, and it doesn't apply now. But oftentimes, most of the time, it took about several years at least. So,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Is there someone? Yeah, we have Don over here. Yeah. Who has?
Yusatz.
Oh, Yusatz, okay. Don or Yusatz, okay. Both of them.
Thank you for your talk. I noticed that the word oppression has got added into famine and war. So my question is along those lines. And the history of our country and larger civilizations about oppression based on the constructed category of race is really, you know, top of my mind and probably for many of us. So my question is around the balance between accepting the way things are, and like you said, it just may not change. And that balance of, I have the time and resources to do something about it. So whereas I'm having trouble balancing that acceptance versus what, even if it's throwing one starfish back in the sea, should I do something about it?
Yeah, and that is the big question, and it's not an easy one for any of us to answer. But the question of what is acceptance is not the same as is not the same as passivity. It's not the same as saying, this is just how things are and they're never going to change. That's not what we mean by acceptance. What we mean by acceptance is, here's how things are in this moment. I believe that, and faith, to me, one of the things that faith does is it says, I think there's a way that this can change. It's seeing possibilities. And maybe that's what hope does too. It's seeing the possibilities of how things might change. Or even without necessarily seeing the how, not necessarily seeing all of the details of it, but seeing that maybe we can envision something different, even if we don't know how to get there. And being willing to to entertain that hope and that faith, and maybe even making a commitment, which may be specific or it may not, depending on our understanding at any given moment. I was thinking about how when I got into this practice to begin with, at one point I went to Kyogen and I said, I don't know how to do what I'm doing. And he just smiled at me because he's like, yeah, that's kind of how it is. Sometimes we do things out of an instinct, is the way I usually think of it. There's something instinctive that arises in me that says, okay, I'm going to go this direction. This is the way I'm going forward. And I don't know what that looks like. I don't know where I'm going, how to do it, the steps to take, all of that kind of stuff. I just don't know that. And that's, I've learned to trust that over the years. I've learned to have faith in that process for me, for myself, and the way I work. And so to me, acceptance, equanimity, patience, forbearance, all of those kinds of words, isn't about saying, I'm going to just put up with this because there's nothing I can do. Sometimes you do have to put up with something, but it isn't the same thing. Sometimes it's a question of, in this moment, this is how things are. And if you can't see that realistically and clearly, then you're not seeing clearly and you're not going to be able to help. You're not going to be able to do anything about it. So that's where we have to start. But we don't end there. We don't stop there. We're just about to time. We might be have time for one more quick one or not.
Are there any in the Zendo, Genko?
Yeah, okay. I do. I actually have a couple in here, but I think we're only going to be able to do one, so let's call this the last right. call here.
Thank you so much. I just had a thought about faith, and how it might be letting go of doubt, like letting go of the doubt about our experience and the truth that we actually recognize. And like the, you know, like maybe letting go of the doubt that about why we practice and the basic goodness. And that kind of faith to me is like just why Buddhism is about joy. To me, so maybe I just wanted to share that and see what you, if you had something to say about it.
Yeah, it's joy is, well, it is one of the seven factors of enlightenment that we're studying right now, and so it's definitely a vital part of Buddha's teachings. Doubt, as I mentioned, kind of comes in a couple of different flavors. And doubt, it can be profoundly helpful and useful to us if it stays in a matter of inquiry, of questioning rather than statements. So I think it's always, well, it's been incredibly powerful for me to keep asking this question, is that true? What's really true in this situation? And I think that's a lot of what we're doing with Buddhist teachings, is trying to see clearly what's really true, and then looking to see if there's something that I need to do with that, which may or may not be the case, but at least to see it very clearly for what it is, and to see our own interaction with that as clearly as possible at the same time. But the Buddha started out teaching, you know, when he was asked what it is that he teaches, he started out saying, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. So you can't get away from this business of suffering. The first noble truth is suffering. And in many ways, to me, that's a joyful thing. Yeah. Somebody finally acknowledged, you know, that life sucks, right? But again, it's a place to start. We don't end there. We move along. And it encompasses a lot, and that's kind of what we do. So don't sell doubt short, because it can play a really vital role.
Yeah, and I think that the lack of doubt in what you said about, you know, what we see as truth through our inquiry keeps us really inspired to keep moving.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so we are at time. I want to thank you all for your kind attention, and